Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Nishad Edibaum. He's an oral maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Stamford, Connecticut. Nishad, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. I'm excited to talk to you. Could you at first just give us a brief history of your training and your current practice setup?
Sure. So I'm in private practice in Stamford. I'm also attached to Yale New Haven's residency program, OMFS residency program. And I'm a clinical instructor there, and I run their implant didactic course up at Yale. I did my dental training at Boston University and then my OMFS residency at Loyola University in Chicago.
Then
I moved to Connecticut.
Very nice. Do you know our good friend David Solomon at all?
Oh, yeah, very well. Yes. Yes, very well. He's also attached to Yale at Yale. So
yes, that's right. Oh, that's great. Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. We were both in residency.
Oh, nice.
For a year together, and so good friends.
Awesome.
Well, that's great. So I invited you on the podcast because I wanted to talk a little bit about your Amos lecture on self-reported antibiotics and the potential for them to be risk factors, or self-reported antibiotic allergies being potential risk factors for dental implant failure. Can you talk to us just a little bit about how you got involved in this topic?
Yeah, so that lecture that I, the presentation I gave at Amos was based on the research paper that we did. And the research paper was basically, it was a systematic review with a meta-analysis to see whether patients who self-reported a penicillin allergy, just it was specifically for penicillin allergy and were administered clindamycin, did these patients have a higher risk of implant failure or not, based on the studies out there. So this all started about, I would say, 2 or 3 years ago, where, you know, I started looking at the cases that failed, the implant cases that failed, and I was surprised to find a common denominator there where all these patients, I would say more than 90% of those failures, had an underlying history of being penicillin allergic, and were given most of the time clindamycin. And that got me started on actually doing this research. And the findings that we came up with were quite significant.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I haven't noticed that in my own patients, but also haven't been looking for that in the past either. So that's a pretty interesting finding. And then what did your kind of research show in your Amos article?
So what we did is we did a systematic review, which, you know, we go through sources like PubMed, Scopus, and out of more than 500 studies, we could only come up with 4 good solid studies. These are all retrospective studies. And what we found was we could clearly show that patients who had a penicillin allergy and were administered clindamycin had a 3.3 times higher rate of implant failure. So that pretty much what we showed was that, so if you're giving clindamycin, you're probably looking at roughly about a 10 to 11% failure rate. But the important thing is that you have a 3.3 times higher risk of implant failure in patients who were administered clindamycin.
That's really interesting. Do you have any, you know, kind of conclusions or thoughts about why that would be the case?
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit. What I want to emphasize here is that, you know, when we get our patients who come in with a penicillin allergy label, typically what we do as clinicians is that we say, okay, you're allergic, let's give you an alternative antibiotic. We rarely spend time, you know, getting a thorough drug allergy history. And if you really go and, spend some time with these patients, you realize that most of these allergies are not true allergies. They're usually, you know, my mom told me, or I had a rash when I was a young kid. And most commonly, you'll get this one. The most common reason is, yes, I had a rash when I was a kid. Or, you know, even my mother has it, and therefore my mom said I shouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. So those are not allergies. And what we've shown, and there's a huge, huge body of literature now in the medical literature coming out, which shows that these patients are not truly pen allergic. In fact, only 0.01% of these patients, and that's an important number, 0.01% of these patients who self-report a penicillin allergy are going to have a life-threatening allergic reaction. And what we also showed in our study was 98% of patients who self-report a penicillin allergy are not allergic. So these are staggering numbers. It's almost like a healthcare epidemic that we have created, both physicians and us dentists, where we inadvertently validate this penicillin allergy when it's completely a false label.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
Yeah.
We had another guest on our show talk a little bit about this topic of how often patients don't really have an allergy that they report. And it is really interesting and probably merits a lot more of our attention. And like you're saying, just focus on really figuring out, you know, if they had an allergy. I guess, how do we know for sure that a patient has a penicillin allergy?
Yeah. So firstly, you know, patients who are not given penicillin in the medical literature has clearly shown that they have a higher risk of C. diff, they have a higher risk of MRSA, they have a higher risk of VRE infections. So from the medical standpoint, also, this makes a lot of sense to get these patients, you know, really get a good history and then get them tested. So what we came up with is we suggested what we called a delabeling protocol. So firstly, a thorough history is mandatory. And then what you should do is get these patients tested by your local allergist. We divided these, what we suggested in our protocol is divide patients into low risk and high risk. So low risk patients would be patients who gave kind of an innocuous history. My mom told me I was allergic, or I had a rash when I was a kid, or I got stomach upset. Those are considered low risk individuals. And believe it or not, those patients can be safely delabeled by literally giving one tablet of amoxicillin and then being observed for 1 hour. Whereas the high-risk patients who developed a, you know, rash within an hour, so that's called an IgE-mediated reaction. So if you develop a rash within an hour of being given a drug, then that is an IgE-mediated reaction. Those kind of patients, pregnant patients, are considered high-risk, and those have to have a skin test plus an oral challenge of amoxicillin. Now, I have to say, we don't recommend you do this in your office. This must be done by a allergist. So, you know, that's one of the first things I did once I started doing this research was that I developed an excellent relationship with my local allergist. And now she gets patients in within a few hours, gets them tested. I can prescribe amoxicillin and they are safely delabeled, hopefully for the rest of their lives.
Wow, nice. That's great. Yeah, that's good to hear that you can get someone into the allergist that quickly and that it's efficient process to figure that out. Excellent. And then, the next question is, you know, so why is it that, I guess, is the increase in implant failure because you're having to give clindamycin? Is it something about clindamycin, or is it something about them having an allergy, that reaction, more inflammatory response to something going on with the implant? Or what do you think?
Yeah, so that requires much more research. We don't know exactly. What I can tell you based on the limited data that we have is that we have shown, not we specifically, our team, but other researchers have shown that clindamycin actually causes an upregulation in Prevotella species. And Prevotella is a predominant species in causing peri-implantitis. So we do know that clindamycin can cause an increase in salivary levels of Prevotella. And there is a study which in vitro has shown that clindamycin may impact osteoblastic activity. So that's the kind of the limited research we have. Why? What is wrong with, what is clindamycin doing differently? But that certainly requires far more research.
Okay. I mean, for your own patients, who end up being that small percent that really are penicillin allergic, what are you prescribing them as the alternative antibiotic?
Yeah, so believe it or not, I've sent hundreds of patients, have not had one patient come back with a true allergy. Not one.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you implement this and your listeners implement this, you'll get the same conclusion that, not one of them, well, you might get some which do come back, but I've not had one patient fail the skin test.
Wow.
Which is the skin. Now, the skin test has a very high, what we call a negative predictive value, which means that it is very accurate. It's close to 100%. That detects hypersensitivity. So that's hypersensitivity is that IgE-mediated response I was talking about. So I've not had a single patient where the allergist has said, this is a true penicillin allergy. I mean, to answer your question, you can give any other alternative. You can go to azithromycin. That's fine. You can give azithromycin if you do have a true allergic reaction.
Okay.
But we don't have, we don't have studies to show is azithromycin also appropriate. I mean, we don't have that. The research, this is kind of a newer topic, and we don't have adequate, research on, for example, amoxicillin versus azithromycin, and we cannot make clear recommendations.
Hey, real quick, attention to all residents and fellows who graduated within the last 6 months. Kalos Martin is offering one-time sale pricing for newly graduated oral and maxillofacial surgeons. The sale includes discounts on a Bienair Chiro Pro with 5 handpieces, the Spectra G6 headlight, which is awesome, oral surgery instrumentation, and in-office bone graft kit components. This is an incredible deal, so don't forget to ask your KLS reps about this. So please enjoy.
Got it.
Okay. So further research needs to be done to kind of figure out more of the details of what's going on here.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, this is a great start. At least it helps us kind of be aware of, what to do with those people who report penicillin allergies and, kind of what can happen if we do have to switch to clindamycin, and educating them and all that stuff is good information for sure.
Yep.
Any other comments on this topic?
I often, when I talk about this topic, the question is, what is your alternative protocol? And I think the emphasis of the true message in our from our paper based on the data is, don't try and seek an alternative antibiotic. Get these patients tested, because medically speaking also, it is far better to prescribe beta-lactam antibiotics should they require hospital utilization. And especially in the head and neck setting, there's no question that beta-lactam antibiotics are still frontline. This is quite an amazing thing. In 2028, we'll be celebrating 100 years for the discovery of penicillin by Alexander Fleming. And till today, 100 years later, almost 100 years later, it's still a frontline antibiotic. And it's quite amazing how it has stood up to the test of time. So I do think the emphasis here is, when you have a penicillin allergy patient, you have to spend time educating the patient. You probably are not allergic. In fact, it's highly likely you're not allergic. And from your health standpoint, and also potentially to get better results with your with our implants, we should test you. But that to say that, you have to preempt that by developing a good relationship with your allergist, you know, speaking with them, showing them the data. And then, you know, once they're convinced that, yes, this is right, then, you know, I think they'll be on board.
Got it. Yeah, that is pretty amazing how effective the penicillin group is and important it is to figure out if they're allergic or not. I mean, another topic, I guess, that kind of pivots off of this topic is, you know, do you need to give antibiotics to every single implant patient? You know?
Yes. So that's a great point you bring up. So we do have limited studies on that. And what we found is that there are a couple of studies. One study showed that if you do not give antibiotics to your implant patients, one out of every 25 patients will have an implant failure. Another study showed one out of 33 patients will have an implant failure if you do not prescribe an antibiotic. So the question then becomes, if you even if you take the 1 in 33, you have a 3% failure rate right there. So in my practice, you know, and I'm sure in your practice, you probably don't want to have that 3% failure rate when you can quite easily prevent that by prescribing the appropriate antibiotic. So we do have limited studies on that. And that's why I do prescribe antibiotics to all my implant patients. Now, the big question is, what is the, you know, I get asked this a lot, what is the dosage? So again, we don't have a consensus on that. What I can tell you based on the data we have is that you probably are okay with 2 grams of amoxicillin 1 hour before, you know, to prevent that 1 in 25 or 1 in 33 implant failures.
Okay. As opposed to 7 days after or something
correct.
Like that.
Correct. So in our paper, the most common posology was 2 grams 1 hour before. There was one of the 4 studies which gave antibiotics for 10 days. You know, so it's the post-operative posology is varied. I don't think that matters as much as giving the appropriate antibiotic. So, but the most common posology was 2 grams 1 hour before of amoxicillin.
Got it. Is that what your protocol is, or is
what you do? Actually, my protocol is I started 2 days before, 875 BID, or if depending on weight, I sometimes do 500 BID or TID, and I started 2 days before and continue for a total of 7 days.
Got it.
But again, that's my protocol. It's not really, it's, you know, like I said, the data is limited on that.
Yes. Okay. Well, yeah, good to hear what you're doing and kind of your experience and what the data is showing. It's all really great information. Do you have any, did you come across your research as far as, do you have any information on the data on how many, like what percent of oral surgeons are prescribing antibiotics to implant patients? I assume it's a very high percent, but do you know at all?
No, I don't know on the top of my head. People I've spoke to, I would say most of them would, you know, just anecdotally, I do think most oral surgeons are prescribing antibiotics, I would assume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the most of the people I, you know, have talked to do, but I do know some who don't, or will just do a topical, like, you know, rinse with chlorhexidine beforehand, stuff like that. But it's interesting how there's so many different protocols for giving antibiotics or not giving it and all that stuff.
Yeah, you know, there are some studies which have shown even just a pre-op chlorhexidine rinse can reduce your implant failure rate. So there are some studies which show just chlorhexidine might be effective enough.
Interesting.
So, you know, yeah. So there are some studies showing that.
Excellent. Well, good stuff to review, and I appreciate you doing that review for us. If there are listeners who kind of have further questions about your research, are you okay if they contact you, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. They can email me.
Okay. Excellent. Well, I end every podcast with what I call the rapid fire questions. So if you're good with that, I'll have a few more questions for you.
Sure.
The first question is, what is the best book you've read in the past year?
Oh, the best book I've read in the past year, I would say, is a book called The Buddha's Mind. It is a psychology book based on, you know, yeah.
This is kind of a self-help book or how?
Yes, it is.
Nice. Okay, I'll have to look that up. I love books like that. All right, next question is, what is the most helpful non-oral surgery thing that you do in your life that helps you with your daily oral surgery skills?
I would say playing the piano.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely helps.
How does that help you out with oral surgery?
I think it keeps me, helps me keep focused. It helps with me, helps my manual dexterity stay the way it is. It's also very relaxing.
Oh, for sure. That's great. Next question. What forceps do you use to extract tooth number 12?
A regular upper universal. And if they're root tips, then I use a special root tip forceps.
Okay. Excellent. Okay, so not the ash forceps, or do you use the ash?
Nah, I don't use. I sometimes use the ash, but I like the root tip forceps if it's very it's tiny.
Okay, sounds good. How about, what is the best movie or TV series you've watched in the past year?
The best TV series, I would say, actually the new one, the Ahsoka series, Star Wars.
Oh yeah,
I'm a big Star Wars fan. I love the franchise, so I would say nice. Ahsoka.
Sounds good. I haven't watched that, but it's on my list to watch. I need to.
Oh yeah, it's great fun.
Okay. And then final question is, what is your favorite quote?
My favorite quote, everything begins and ends with the mind.
I love that. The power of the mind. Yeah, it's a powerful tool.
Yep.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, Nishad, thank you so much for taking the time to do this morning. Best of luck in your practice, and hopefully we can reconnect and do another episode down the road.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
Sounds good. Have a good day.
Bye. You too. Bye, Grant. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you'd like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.